Lower Burke Street proved to be a line of fine houses lying in the vague borderland between Notting Hill and Kensington. The particular one at which my cabman pulled up had an air of smug and demure respectability in its old-fashioned iron railings, its massive folding door, and its shining brasswork. All was in keeping with a solemn butler who appeared framed in the pink radiance of a tinted electrical light behind him. "Yes, Mr. Culverton Smith is in. Dr. Watson. Very good, sir. I will take up your card." My humble name and title did not appear to impress Mr. Culverton Smith. Through the half-open door I heard a high, petulant, penetrating voice. "Who is this person? What does he want?" "Dear me, Staples, how often have I said that I am not to be disturbed in my hours of study?" There came a gentle flow of soothing explanation from the butler. "Well, I won't see him, Staples. I can't have my work interrupted like this. I'm not at home. Say so. Tell him to come in the morning if he really must see me." Again the gentle murmur. "Well, well, give him that message. He can come in the morning, or he can stay away. My work must not be hindered." I thought of Holmes tossing upon his bed of sickness, and counting the minutes, perhaps, until I could bring help to him. It was not a time to stand upon ceremony. His life depended upon my promptness. Before the apologetic butler had delivered his message, I had pushed past him and was in the room. With a shrill cry of anger, a man rose from a reclining chair beside the fire. I saw a great yellow face, coarse-grained and greasy, with heavy double chin and two sullen, menacing grey eyes, which glared at me from under tufted and sandy brows. A high, bald head had a small velvet smoking cap poised coquettishly upon one side of its pink curve. The skull was of enormous capacity, and yet, as I looked down, I saw, to my amazement, that the figure of the man was small and frail, twisted in the shoulders and back like one who had suffered from rickets in his childhood. "What's this?" he cried in a high, screaming voice. "What is the meaning of this intrusion? Didn't I send you word that I would see you tomorrow morning?" "I am sorry," said I, "but the matter cannot be delayed. Mr. Sherlock Holmes—" The mention of my friend's name had an extraordinary effect upon the little man. The look of anger passed in an instant from his face. His features became tense and alert. "Have you come from Holmes?" he asked. "I have just left him." "What about Holmes? How is he?"
"He is desperately ill. That is why I have come."
The man motioned me to a chair and turned to resume his own. As he did so, I caught a glimpse of his face in the mirror over the mantelpiece. I could have sworn that it was set in a malicious and abominable smile. Yet I persuaded myself that it must have been some nervous contraction which I had surprised, for he turned to me an instant later with genuine concern upon his features.
"I'm sorry to hear this," said he. "I only know Mr. Holmes through some business dealings which we have had, but I have every respect for his talent and his character. He is an amateur of crime, as I am of disease. For him the villain, for me the microbe. There are my prisons," he continued, pointing to a row of bottles and jars which stood upon a side table. "Among those gelatine cultivations, some of the very worst offenders in the world are now doing time." "It was on account of your special knowledge that Mr. Holmes desired to see you. He has a high opinion of you, and thought that you were the one man in London who could help him." The little man started, and the jaunty smoking cap slid to the floor.
"Why," he asked, "why should Mr. Holmes think that I could help him in his trouble?"
"Because of your knowledge of Eastern diseases."
"But why should he think that this disease which he has contracted is Eastern?"
"Because, in some professional inquiry, he has been working among Chinese sailors down in the docks."
Mr. Culverton Smith smiled pleasantly and picked up his smoking cap.
"Oh, that's it, is it?" said he. "I trust the matter is not so grave as you suppose. How long has he been ill?"
"About 3 days."
Is he delirious?
Occasionally.
Tut, tut, this sounds serious. It would be inhuman not to answer his call. I very much resent any interruption to my work, Dr. Watson, but this case is certainly exceptional. I will come with you at once.
I remembered Holmes' injunction.
I have another appointment, said I.
Very good. I will go alone. I have a note of Mr. Holmes' address. You can rely upon my being there within half an hour at most.
It was with a sinking heart that I re-entered Holmes' bedroom. For all that I knew, the worst might have happened in my absence. To my enormous relief, he had improved greatly in the interval. His appearance was as ghastly as ever, but all trace of delirium had left him, and he spoke in a feeble voice, it is true, but with even more than his usual crispness and lucidity.
"Well, did you see him, Watson?"
"Yes, he's coming."
"Admirable, Watson, admirable. You are the best of messengers."
"He wished to return with me."
"That would never do, Watson. That would be obviously impossible. Did he ask what ailed me?"
"I told him about the Chinese in the East End."
"Exactly. Well, Watson, you have done all that a good friend could. You can now disappear from the scene."
"I must wait and hear his opinion, Holmes."
"Of course you must. But I have reasons to suppose that his opinion would be very much more frank and valuable if he imagines that we are alone. There is just room behind the head of my bed, Watson."
"My dear Holmes,
I fear there is no alternative, Watson. The room does not lend itself to concealment, which is as well, as it is the less likely to arouse suspicion. But just there, Watson, I fancy that it could be done."
Suddenly he sat up with a rigid intentness upon his haggard face.
"There are the wheels, Watson. Quick, man, if you love me, and don't budge, whatever happens. Whatever happens, do you hear? Don't speak, don't move, just listen with all your ears."
Then, in an instant, his sudden access of strength departed, and his masterful, purposeful talk droned away into the low, vague murmurings of a semi-delirious man. From the hiding-place into which I had been so swiftly hustled, I heard the footfalls upon the stair, with the opening and the closing of the bedroom door. Then, to my surprise, there came a long silence, broken only by the heavy breathings and gaspings of the sick man. I could imagine that our visitor was standing by the bedside and looking down at the sufferer. At last, that strange hush was broken.